Ever since the inception of the Baker Street Journal in 1946, it has been the gold standard for Sherlockian criticism, playing the game, articles on Holmes-related Victoriana, and the occasional cheeky essay. To boot, the folks running the show are great friends of the Babes. To learn more, you need only visit www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gazadine Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers for One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. Another brilliant book published with Gazadine Books is Matthias Boström and Matt Laffey's Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press, Gazadine Books, or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
This podcast is in promotion of Tutu and Beacon in Atlanta, Georgia. You can find all the information you need at www.tutuandbeacon.com.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you tutu?
How many recording devices do we have going?
Three.
We have three recording devices going.
Can we confirm that they're all functioning at the moment?
They are all functioning at this moment.
Hurrah. All right. Then we'll get started. Welcome to the Baker Street Babes live podcast here at 221 BCon 2016. We are joined by special guest David Nellis, which we're very pleased about. At the moment, we are live with four babes.
Taylor's here, of course.
I'm Ashley.
Amy.
Sarah.
And we'll jump right in. Who's in charge of the Baker Street Babes honorary babes questions?
We can kind of go down. Sure.
So, David, how did you come to Sherlock Holmes the first time?
I was contacted, as usual, by my agent, who said that there was this program that they were making called Sherlock. We didn't know that at the time it was a sort of a modern look at Sherlock. So they just sent me the couple of sides. They didn't send the script at that point. And I went down to, I think it was in Richmond or Twickenham, to the studios and of Hartswood, and met Steve, and Mark was there, and I knew Mark, we have a mutual friend, but I didn't really know him too well at that point. And I read my sides, and they gave me some notes, and I read them again, and that was my introduction.
Now, had you known of the stories? I know that's a big cultural thing where you're from, so were you aware of that? Big cultural thing, yeah. Understatement.
Sherlock's big in Newcastle.
Yeah.
Well, you know, especially there. Were you aware of them as a child or as a young adult?
I hadn't read many, as a child. It was only subsequently after the auditions, or coming up to the audition, I dipped into the stories, and fantastic, aren't they? I mean, they just they stand up now as well as they ever did, and I think that's what the skill is that's been in the writing from Mark and from Steve, is that they came upon the stories as fans. I think if they'd just been writers for hire and had come upon these stories and been told, oh, you need to write a modern Sherlock, I don't think it would have worked. It's because they have such reverence for Conan Doyle's stories that it's worked so well.
Great. Okay, question number two is, now that you have read some of the stories, do you have a favorite?
I keep coming back to The Hound of the Baskervilles. I just think it's fascinating. You know, I like the fact that it's out of London. It's, when you go down there to where it's set, it's a very odd, mysterious place up on the moors, and you can't imagine things going on there. I was up there about, must have been about 10 years ago, and I thought I saw a bear on the moors, and it was a wild boar, you know, a wild pig up on the moors. But it was really, I was on my own, and it was really unsettling. And he's just thinking, my eyes aren't quite seeing this, but I know I am. And so I keep coming back to The Hound of the Baskervilles, I think.
Excellent.
So that's favorite story. And then we would ask, and this might be an easy question, but your favorite adaptation, and it's perfectly fine to say your own.
I do like that one. Yeah, I mean, I was sort of watching them recently, watching some of them recently, and sometimes I forget the name of the episodes.
Right.
I'm sure everyone will shout at me. The in series one with the Chinese
blind beggar.
Yeah, I just think that's very cleverly done. Some of the keep coming back to the way they use the sort of ciphers and the codes, so we all get sort of hooked into it because of these sort of ancient myths and legends, and I think that the sort of theatricality of that really works well in the blind beggar as well. And also, to get a little sort of semi-political hat on, there's not enough jobs for Chinese actors in Britain, and we always talk about, I'm very involved in equity in the British Actors Union, and it was fantastic to see so many Chinese actors in one episode, and in a non-stereotypical way, and so that was a great thrill as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. And the final question we ask sometimes is, of the characters in Sherlock Holmes, who would you want to have tea with?
Who would I want to have tea with?
Or beer, or whiskey.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A beverage.
Yes. People have been observing me over the weekend. It's, I think, I really like Lestrade. I think he's got a really sort of interesting stories. And he's strikes me as a very funny guy. I really like Lestrade, and I also like what Rupert Graves has brought to the, I think he's brought a hell of a lot to that character. He's really sort of rounded him off a lot. He's taken what the writers have given him, and he's really run with it, and I think he's almost, he could have his own show on his own, a little side.
I'd watch.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's fair to say we would all take Rupert Graves down.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Right?
All at once, the whole.
All at once.
Yeah, collectively.
Collectively, yes. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, from answering those questions, you are now an honorary Baker Street babe.
Wow. It's a great honor. Thank you very much.
It's kind of an honor.
It's half
an honor. You don't have to lie. We know who we are. It's okay. So I think Amy in particular was taking very good notes at your Q&A.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And
yeah.
So can probably direct this better than I can.
Oh,
so
well.
I'm going to turn it
over
to
well,
you.
Okay, well, first of all, actually something that I heard in the stranger's room, part of your ongoing growth of fame is that someone tweeted you that they saw you at breakfast, but maybe someone else in your life was not so excited about this. So could you share with us about that?
Yes, I was Skyping my family back home, and I've got two lovely daughters. They're 10 and 12, and someone had said, I've just had just been sitting next to Nellidge at breakfast, and my little one, Lila, who's 10, said, what's the problem? I sit next to you every day. And you're never happy. So, she couldn't believe that everyone would say, yeah, he seems so nice and so cheerful all the time. Like, is that you? Have they sent you? Are they just flying you around, Sherlock-like? And then they're going to land you at some airfield, and another Nellidge comes out, the cheerful one. So, yeah, most actors are not very good until about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, for various reasons, I think. But, yes.
They did not tell us that when they scheduled a podcast at 11.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is but back home, it's actually 4 p.m.
Right. Oh, there we go. Right. We're going to be on UK time. That's right.
That's right. So would you say that Stamford is your favorite character, or do you have another favorite character?
Within the realm of my career, or within Sherlock?
Either one. Cool. Maybe start with Sherlock and branch off into your career.
I think Mrs. Hudson has to be everybody's real favorite. You know? I mean, I grew up watching Eunice Stubbs, and anyone seen a program called Wurzel Gummidge? Mm-hmm. She used to be in, and she's a national treasure, you know. And to be able to have some time with her and see her and say hi to someone like that, my sort of 12-year-old self just comes in from above and goes, "Oh my God, that's Eunice Stubbs!" So I think she is, and I think, oh yeah, it's again like what I was saying about Rupert, what she brings to it, you know, her own skill as an actress, just really brings that three and that 2-2-1-B household together. You know, you really get a sense of this woman as she's coming in, and there's bullet holes in the walls, and she's just, oh, Sherlock. So I think Mrs. Hudson, my favourite role. It's hard. I do a lot of theatre, and I was lucky enough to be in a show that probably many of you know, called Billy Elliot, and I played George, the boxing trainer, the sort of comedian of the piece, and it was a great thrill because Lee Hall, who wrote the play, was a friend of mine at school at comprehensive at secondary school, and. So 30 years later, he writes this play, and you're in the West End of London in a play wrote by your friend with one of my best friends playing the dad in this fantastic piece, which is also my story almost of the Northeast and of the decline of the mines, and so it was a very personal story again, both personally and politically. That was a great time of struggle for my region, and we're still sort of seeing the effects today. It's very serious at 11 o'clock in the morning.
That's all right. We'll take it.
Do you have a favourite thing that's happened to you so far at Con?
I think it has to... Well, there's two. I think the fridge has to be... has everyone seen the fridge?
Yes.
Last night, sort of comparing the costume event was just it was eye-opening to see that the level of, you know, the level of passion and the level of skill that people had brought to these costumes. It was absolutely extraordinary, and of course John's Victorian mustache. We can't forget that. We cannot forget that. So yeah, it's just sort of being around people who've got this incredible love for something. I have this crazy love for my team, Newcastle United, and most people think people like us are bonkers. So I'm used to people being in situations where the outside world thinks you're a bit odd and a bit mad. So I quite like that. I quite like people with a singular passion. It's a thing of mine.
Excellent. Well, we're all quite mad here. Yeah. You're in good company.
Sarah has a question of something that stuck out to her at your Q&A.
Yes, you mentioned that you've done stand-up comedy.
Yeah, back in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, when it was just sort of taking off in Britain, the sort of growth of sort of new comedy or alternative comedy, and I did about 5 years, and I loved it, and so I did it for about 5 years, and then I had a gap of 20 years, and then last year I thought I'm going to try it again, just to sort of scare myself. I was in a long-running play, Warhorse in the West End, and with a long-running show, it gets a bit like Groundhog Day. You sort of need to find something in your life that's a bit challenging and a bit scary, and so I said, well, I'm going to try out, do some stand-up. And instead of going outside of London and just doing it and coming back in, I made the sort of crazy mistake of inviting all my friends and neighbours and children. And
hard to
critics.
Yeah, harshest critics. But it went all right. And so I'm floating the idea of doing some more. Yeah, I'm sort of keep on writing with. So this weekend has given me a lot of material. So don't be surprised if you see yourself.
We do want to ask about Warhorse, film and play that many of us are familiar with and have a lot of love for. Just tell us what you played, your involvement.
So I was Sergeant Thunder, which is the sort of the gruff sergeant major part. Again, it was the sort of main comedy role, sort of element of the play. And I did a year and a half in that. And it's 37 actors and these incredible life-size puppets. Sometimes of which you would forget that you were not on stage, even after months and months, that you weren't on stage with a real horse. You just glimpse it on the side, and the skill of the incredible puppeteers and the puppets themselves. That was a very special piece of art. It's just finished in London about 2 weeks ago. But I think it's going to come back on tour, and it'll be on world tour for a long time. So that is, to be involved in something which people will say in 50 years' time, it's like the sort of equivalent of people saying, oh, did you see Laurence Olivier's Hamlet? Mm-hmm. Or did you see, but so to be a small part of something, an institution like that for the National Theatre was a huge honour, huge.
Wow. There was something else you said about that. After you had been performing for a long time, there was something that you did regarding the audience to kind of dial yourself in, and I was really touched by that. So could you elaborate on that?
Yeah. Sometimes in a long run, it can be very monotonous. You need to sort of shock yourself into imagining that it's the first time that you've performed this play, because it is the first time that the majority of the audience have seen this play for the first time. So I sort of give you a sort of actor's rituals, if you like. And one of the things I do, there's a huge auction scene at the beginning, so you're able to sort of look out in the audience and spot someone. And I tend to spot a child who'd come, and they would be on the sort of second or third row, and you just pinpoint them and just think, right, this one's for you. That could be that kid's birthday. They could have flown in from Europe. They could have come down from Scotland. It could be the biggest event of their life. And it's pinpointing something like that and just makes you say, right, let's not, we call it phoning it in. Let's really go for this performance. And it also helps you as an actor, if you're on stage and you're phoning it in, it's interminable because you've done it 450 times. But if you just hone it down to the individual and tell that story. And then at the end, you look out and the kid's sort of been moved, and the parents, everyone's crying. and it's a thrill.
That's neat. All right, getting back to Stanford himself a little bit, we would like to pick your brain about something that you kind of started on yesterday in a humorous way, which is we have the implication that Stanford and John Watson maybe meet at times that we don't see.
Yeah.
So we would ask again, how do you see those meetings? What is happening in them, and what are people saying?
Yeah. I think I suggested that I sort of see the characters as meeting in pubs. And
you amaze us.
Yeah, I know. What is it with English actors and pubs? Beats me. And I think he's just... he says to, I think I said yesterday that he says to Stanford, what did I do to you that you brought me together with this man? what did I ever say? But I think living with a character like Sherlock Holmes, you'd need to share it with somebody. And I think there's a certain mutual admiration between Stanford and John. That about this guy, he is crazy and he is one of a kind, but he is a genius, I think there'd be a need to share that with somebody. That I think that's Mike's role in that piece.
Very much so. And for the future of Mike, what is your dream for who he might work with or what he might do?
My dream is that he's in every episode. Now that we start to see more around the place, so I think I said yes to Molly that I think what Louis Brealey's brought to that part is absolutely fantastic. I think we started on the same day on the pilot, I seem to remember, and it's been brilliant to watch another actress who I didn't know, to see what she's brought to the role, what she brought to the special. I thought was more special, and just to see how she as an actress has handled that sort of fame and how it's sort of grown her as an actress, and I think she's handled it absolutely brilliantly, you know, and so I'd like to have some scenes with Molly.
So wouldn't we all?
Yes.
So since you've been here at the con, I'm sure that you've heard some interesting theories about Stanford that had just never occurred to you before.
I read Twitter.
Yeah. So. What is perhaps the most astonishing thing that someone has suggested to you that you just kind of go, really? People think that?
That Stanford was Moriarty. I'm not sure he's that. He's clever, but I don't think he's clever enough to be Sherlock's nemesis or equal. Unless that is the triple bluff. that's the act, that he's this mild-mannered. It's like on Scooby-Doo. Not Scooby-Doo, Hong Kong Phooey, the mild-mannered janitor. That he's that figure, and he comes in at the end, and there's a final scene, many, many years to come, over the Reichenbach Falls again. And he's unveiled as Moriarty.
In a wedding dress,
yeah.
It was him.
No, I had a photo date last night with the ladies playing the Abominable Bride, and my kids are absolutely terrified of the Abominable Bride. So much so that if one of them is in the shower, the other one will stand outside the door just going, "You!" And you're in the kitchen, and you just hear, "Dad, tell her to stop, please." So I've got that. I'm going to get that picture of me and the Abominable Bride, and just put it on the fridge door for when they're being particularly naughty.
So in other words, they take after you.
Yeah. Well. Yes.
I'm going to start doing that to people. Even people who don't know the reference. I'm just going to walk. I do that to my students. I'm just going to walk into the classroom and go, "You!" And see what happens.
I did read, I think it was Tumblr, people saying they were singing the song around the house and like their mom was like screaming every time. Yeah. Don't antagonize your
parents. I don't think many people would be going into a maze anymore. Yeah.
Come on, though. If they, you got the series 5 script, and you were, you know, all of a sudden playing Moriarty, you wouldn't throw the script away.
No, I don't. Think
this is not my character's arc. Heard it.
No, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? Yeah.
If they don't know the end game yet.
No, I think the great thing about it is that I think Benedict came out and said that they both started to play these characters very young, and they've got a commitment to the characters, and they want to play them for many years, which I think is considering how stratospheric their careers have gone. I think their commitment to the program is superb. You know, I really, really admire that. And I was saying yesterday that what I admire about Ben and Benedict and Martin is that sometimes in life you get to a certain point and then you get your fame. And all the prestige that goes with it, but also how you use it as an actor, and they do a heck of a lot of good for other actors in the profession, and are able to stand out. And you remember, I've seen the clips after Benedict's Hamlet when he came out, and he sort of just, you know, he's sticking up for those who aren't able to stick up for themselves, and that's very admirable, I think.
And I know I'm going to kind of steal a question, and if it was one of yours, thank you, from yesterday, which is, obviously you started with the unaired pilot, and we've now come a very far ways to the special. What has changed for you and for the show since then, in your experience, specifically?
I think at the beginning we didn't know, or they didn't know how it was all going to be taken. I think, you know, it was a risk to take Sherlock out of the Victorian setting, to place it in this modern and solve the crimes in this modern way while keeping the integrity of Conan Doyle's writing. And so by the time we'd, it almost felt like they'd earned the right to go back and do the Sherlock that everybody thought they were going to do in the very beginning. So to play around with the genre and it coming back to the show, soon we're all very comfortable with seeing in the Victorian times, and then we're on a plane. You know, it was really nice to see how the confidence that you get from when a show has done so well. So it was just for me coming in from outside, it's just sort of reacting to how Benedict and Martin and others have sort of, how their characters have grown. It was just a little, I liked how all the little touches, the niece's 221B rather than 221B, and it was very subtle, very clever.
And I'm sure a lot of things have changed for a lot of us who maybe weren't even into Sherlock Holmes, and our lives have changed greatly since, and we're all, I'm sure, very thankful for that and appreciative of yourself and other actors.
Thank you.
I know, moving to a little different direction, I know you're a big Shakespeare fan.
Yes.
So do you have a dream role in a favourite play?
I do. I keep coming back to King Lear. It's just one of those plays where you watch it as a teenager and you're hooked into a certain character. So you might be looking at the Edmund, Edgar characters, because you might have I've got an elder brother, and you're hooked into that. And I watched it recently, and my dad's not been too well the last couple of years, and I was watching it, and it's about, now I look at it as a man who's this great man who's losing his power, and you know those lines he said, let me not be mad, and it just pings out at you, and you think, oh wow, Shakespeare's such a fantastic writer that he picks up on everybody's greatest fears, and to look at this colossus, this king, and he brought it down to, he's on the heath and he's with his best friend, and he's worried about is that just that loss of that pride. He's not even bothered about, you know, being a king. It's just about his own internal self. So I'd love to. There's many characters. I'd love to play Lear's fool, but one day. Lear himself, I guess. It's extraordinary. I can see five productions a year of, and get something from every single time I see it.
Speaking of seeing it a lot of times a year, you are a frequent attendee of theatre, correct?
Yeah. Not all actors are. Some actors, it's a bit of a what we call a busman's holiday. They're doing it every night. So when they're not working, they don't want to go to the theatre, or they'll only go and see their friends in something. But I really enjoy going to the theatre, even on a bad production. But there'll be something about it, the lighting, or this, or you come out and you say, oh, I just thought that one character who came in and had 10 lines, he just really nailed it. You know, so I think. Also, you're just constantly learning from other actors. You know, you'd be a serious egotist if you thought that you'd learn everything. I've been doing it 25 years this year, and you're still learning. That's why I love to watch plays with older actors. In so you're going back to Lear, you've got a lot of actors who are probably over 60 in the roles, and you're just watching them and thinking that level of sort of control and stillness, and doing, you know, we hear it a lot, you know, don't do too much, and then you think you're on stage, you think, well, no one's going to notice, and then you watch a play rather than being a player, you watch a player and you're going, look at that character, he's doing absolutely nothing, but everybody's focused in on him because of that stillness. So I love players. I love going to watch theatre.
That's marvelous. So if you were cast as Lear's fool, and then you could choose your Lear.
Wow, that's a good question. I think Mark Rylance.
Oh, that's a good choice.
In a few years. Do we all know Mark Rylance? He's some actor. He's
Oscar winner now.
Oscar winner. Yeah, absolutely Oscar winner.
Well deserved.
He's if you can catch his 12th Night is extraordinary. I think when he did it at the Globe Theatre in London, where I've worked, on their resource, on their file, I think you can purchase the production, and it's wow, it's a piece of work with Stephen Fry and Johnny Flynn and others.
I just remember the way he walks.
Yeah, I don't know how he does that thing where he glides. It's like he's on one of those segways. He's got that under his dress. Or yeah.
Mark Rylance and his wheelie feet.
If anybody, if any actor could float, it would be Mark Rylance, I think.
He does, right? In yeah. his normal life. And I want to shout out to Artie, our babe who's not with us, who is probably our number one theater devoted babe. So hi, Artie, if you're listening.
Hello.
I was actually going to ask you who you'd like to work with. I think you mentioned some female actors that you'd like to work with.
Yeah.
As well.
Again, I think Britain is blessed with some brilliant female actresses, people like that have done this journey across to America, like Helen Mirren, Dame Judi Dench, but people like Penelope Wilton, who people may know from Downton Abbey, just extraordinary and an actress. There's a program I don't maybe it came across called Happy Valley, with an actress called Sarah Lancashire, who I've sort of known as an actress to watch for about, you know, 25 years, and suddenly you see someone doing a piece of work and they're suddenly in the right role, or their head is just tuned into that role, and you think, wow, that's taken it several levels above where I thought you were. And it's so yeah, I think to work with people like that to be brilliant.
Awesome. Speaking on the same vein, since you mentioned TV a little bit, what are some shows that you enjoy on television?
Sopranos is my all-time favorite program, with the late James Gandolfini. Breaking Bad. I think it's where you see a character come from one starting point, and that you're allowed the time to discover that arc of a character. It's extraordinary. But I think in Britain, writers like Shane Meadows, who did This Is England, and he revisits the characters sort of every 4 years, and you see where they are. And or director Ken Loach, do we know Ken Loach? Mm-hmm. He's a very political filmmaker.
The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
The Wind That Shakes the Barley, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he comes, you know, his first sort of standpoint is from a sort of political standpoint. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to work with someone like that.
Excellent. And speaking of work, what is your process? Is it the same all the time, or do you have a specific?
I think sometimes it does good to juggle things up a bit. So you know, if you're doing a very lighthearted comedy role, maybe the backstory thing isn't so important. I still like to do some backstory for every character I play. I think it's just important that, unless you've done the same job as your you know, if someone writes the play around you and you're playing yourself, then you need to know where that character has come from, whether they're, you know, a married person, whether they're a religious person, whether they have children, because I don't see how you can go on a stage and portray that if you don't know, you know, where that character's come from, what their stresses are. Are they a manual labourer? So if they are, how tired are they in the evening? How much do they like peace and quiet? But it sort of dipped. I was saying yesterday that's a great hat. That doesn't work on the podcast. Yes. Someone's just
that's just going to be for us in the room. Sorry, listeners. You'll never know.
So yeah, it's sometimes just shocking yourself and just trying a different approach. You know, I was saying that I absolutely love cycling. And if I don't cycle to the theatre, from my house to the theatre is about, on Wars, this is, about 35 minutes. And if I didn't cycle to the theatre, it really sort of scrambled my brain a bit. It was something about you're leaving the house, and then that's your process to get in into your work head. And also, before I go on stage, I have this thing where whatever novel I'm reading, I have to read the whole page of the novel out loud without making any mistakes. And that's a sort of weird superstition, but if I stumble or whatever, and I'm desperately getting towards beginners, and I have to keep going over and over again until I get it right. It's just getting your head into that clear space, I think.
Makes sense.
Have you ever been cast in a role that you just couldn't get into?
I did pantomime a couple of years ago, and I hadn't done it for a while, and I promised my kids that if I went up for this pantomime, that if I did it, if I got the role, I would take it. And unfortunately, I got the role, and I was in a double act, and I just found it really hard to be double acts. I think are organic, and that, you know, quite often the great double acts have sort of grown up together, and you can't make them. I think if I was casting for a double act, I would ask people to come in with their friends, because it's something about, you just know when the other person's got the light, and just to step back, and it's a very hard thing to make work. And although I got on with the guy very, very well, it was just very, I found it very hard, because I like to sort of impro a bit on stage, and you didn't know whether that was going to be okay for the other person, but you were on stage, so you couldn't ask permission. So I found that quite hard. I'd like another crack at it though someday.
Okay, so we know that we did not see Stanford at the wedding. So I have a two-part thing, which is for you to let all of our podcast listeners know the real reason, in the real practical reason. But secondly, we also know that you were at a wedding of a John and Mary. So
yes.
If you want to talk about how that happened, we'd love to hear both of those.
Yeah. So the reason I wasn't at the wedding, there's a lot of theories why I wasn't at the wedding, but the real boring reason was that I was doing the play War Horse. We just couldn't make the schedules work. Tried to get out of doing the play, but that's the way it happens quite often, that you don't know what's coming up, so you agree to a role, and I just couldn't. We just couldn't make it work, which was a real shame, because it was nice to see all those characters suddenly together, and it looked a lot of fun. But my other job when I'm not working is I'm a registrar of marriages. Non-religious marriages, sort of celebrant, and I started doing that about 10 years ago. I've done about 2,500 weddings to date, and about 3 weeks ago I was doing a wedding, and my colleague knows I never mention when I'm doing weddings that I'm an actor or anything, it's their day, and I said, oh, looking at the pieces of paper, and it was a John marrying a Mary, and I said, oh, that's interesting, you know, John and Mary, and the lady said, oh yes, we're, you know, and what's weird, we're huge Sherlock fans. So my colleague sort of looked at me in a sort of go on, tell her. So I said, I play Stanford in. She was like, I thought it was. So that was nice that you were able to sort of bring something extra to their very special day.
You know, the Queen showed up at somebody's wedding. That's nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
And hey, destination wedding. You know.
Yeah, I heard some people got engaged on Friday night. So. If they came to London, I could do the job.
Do you find it difficult to do that where you have obviously very intense theatre and then you're switching over to doing something so different? Do you find it hard to go back and forth?
I think I used to. And now it's a weird thing to do with costume. I put on my my suit and tie and pick up my registrar's bag, and that's and it's almost like playing a role. It's like teachers talk about it a lot, that they're they're not quite themselves in a classroom. They're, you know, what the kids see is different to what to what the what we
our
see in the staff room.
Here. Yeah.
You guys would not believe how cheerful and pleasant I am as a teacher, because I'm such a sarcastic ass. In
and I think it's exactly the, you know, exactly the same. You're putting up. You're putting a persona on as the happy celebrant or the happy registrar, and so sometimes now I can literally go from straight from doing a wedding straight to doing a casting, come back to doing a wedding, and then maybe in the evening do the play.
Wow, I had no idea it was that.
Yeah.
Highly impressive.
How did you decide you wanted to be? Which of your jobs came first?
So I was an actor, and just before my eldest was born, I realised I was going to be quite a stay-at-home dad. My wife's got a profession, and so I wanted to be around the kids and not go away touring or anything like that. And so it was a perfect job. So I could sort of. It wasn't a full-time job. I'm on a sort of rota system, and I can say whether I want to take that particular wedding or not. So it worked perfectly. So there was just an advert in a local paper that said, you know, do you want to join our celebrations? And can you? The great one was it said in fact, are you all right at speaking in public?
Check.
Yeah. So I remember going for the interview and. And there was lots of people, and they had to sort of read this marriage, and they were, dearly beloved, we are, sorry, and then so you go in there, and that's the one thing you can do, you can't do all, I couldn't do a lot of the sort of, at the time, all the computing stuff and all of that, but I could busk this wedding through, and that, and also the sort of, you know, there's that sort of cachet about, oh my goodness, we've got an actor working for us that they seem to think is glamorous, but I don't know why.
My dad officiates weddings as a minister, wow. So I know it's much harder than it.
Yeah, it's fantastic because certainly in East London where I live, it's a very diverse mix of people. It's brilliant. So you can be doing you might do four weddings that day. You might be doing an Ethiopian wedding followed by an Irish wedding followed by Orthodox Jewish wedding, and it's just brilliant because how many other people get to mix with that many layers of society? So I think it's fascinating for me because I can, you know, when it comes back to acting, I can draw on a lot of different characters that I've met, and I do some writing as well, so it's perfect for that.
Excellent. So just as you kind of you phase into acting and into that, we see Stanford kind of entering Sherlock, but we know he has a life outside that. So would you talk a little bit about his professional and personal life as you see it when we're not seeing him?
Well, I think he's I would say definitely a family man. I think originally in the pilot there was some talk of him being this family guy living at home with his wife, kids, and dog, and all of that. So I think that he's a good sort of linking character for that because he's an outsider looking on, and he goes to Bart's hospital and he's working with and he comes across this character and he starts working there and someone says, oh, have you met Sherlock yet? And he said, no, who's this guy? Who's this Sherlock guy? And then he comes in, and I imagine that this guy, Sherlock, comes in and says, oh, yes, could I borrow a head? and 3 pints of your best blood, please. And I think I had this idea in my backstory of him that Stanford was a sort of involved in the neurosciences. Mm-hmm. So he's very interested in people's brains, and what better case study could you have than Sherlock? You know, I think it's interesting to sort of know whether you can bracket a character like Sherlock. Is he just a genius, or is he on the spectrum, or whatever? You know, I think it's very. I think that's what's so interesting about him, is that you find him so hard to pin down to what sort of character that he is. He's not, you know, he comes across as not very affectionate, but then occasionally we do see that he can be affectionate towards, you know, Mrs. Hudson and things like that. And the bold brother thing is the most, having an elder brother myself, I find the Sherlock and Mycroft stuff so interesting.
It's just amazing to think of a guy as affable as Stanford meeting Sherlock. Yeah. Sherlock deducing him, and Stanford's probably like, okay.
Yeah, it's a yin and yang thing, yeah.
Now I have to ask, what kind of dog does Stanford have?
Well, I think you'd have to have a Labrador, yeah.
And 1,000 fanfics were.
Yeah.
What's the dog's name?
No, I only came up with the name of somebody said, what was Stanford's pub name? And those who know me, I'm so competitive. So I had to go away and think of the perfect pub name, and I was thinking of, I'm a Geordie, so I was thinking of Geordie's Rest and all that. And then I was thinking about the Bart's Hospital, and then so I think I called it the Hospital Itty. So, which works slightly better when it's written down than when it's said, but that's what I came up with.
Which he runs with his Labrador.
Yeah, exactly. He's got the pub dog. He's got his Guinness on tap. I think he's a very happy man.
The dog is best friends with Gladstone, right?
Yeah.
Future Gladstone. I want to give you plenty of time before we're kind of at the end here to talk about your upcoming work, which sounded extremely interesting.
Yeah, so I've been out in Romania filming an American series called Harley and the Davidsons, about the birth of the Harley Davidson company for Discovery Channel. And so I come in and I play the guy Mayer, who buys the first ever Harley Davidson back in, I think, 1903. So I've been doing that, and also filming a little part on a British thing called Taboo with Tom Hardy, which is another British actor who's making huge waves right across the world. And that was fantastic to go in and play a part in that. And Mark Gatiss is in that. I haven't got any scenes with him, but Mark is very much an actor in demand, as you know. So he's in that. So it's been a really interesting year, because to go from a long running play, where, you know, it's regular money and you've just got job security, which for an actor is very important, but you sort of lose the variety. Mm-hmm. So to go in and do a little play here and some go across to there and do a telly there and come get to be able to come to places like this, and so I like the variety, but then I like the job security, so it's quite.
Perhaps not the right profession, then.
Yeah, yeah. That's what my wife says.
I love it. Yeah, I think I saw some fan art and fan theories about Tom Hardy as Moran at different points.
So, oh, wow. I've never seen that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of professions with highly stable and reliable income, you mentioned that you also do some writing. So
yeah, I mean, I sort of... You spend a lot of time in trailers or behind set, you know, in theatres, and for your own sanity, you start to write. I think a lot of actors, a lot of young actors I come across, are increasingly writing and making their own films and their own theatre pieces. So I'm writing a thing. It started off being a play, and some people responded on Twitter about I was doing wanted to write something about death. And about how we different approaches to death all around the world, and it became too large a subject, I think. So I personalised it a little bit. My dad, unfortunately, had a stroke a couple of years ago, and he's doing okay. But I find strokes fascinating, because unlike heart attacks or something like that, they're so individualised. And what happens to one person after a stroke isn't exactly the same as what happens to the next person. So it's now, I think, a play about a young man and an older figure, which may or may not be the same person, looking back over their life through after having had this stroke. Yeah, very cheerful, isn't it? It'll be a comedy, don't worry about that. It'd be called Different Strokes. Sorry. Couldn't resist. I just couldn't resist it.
You were doing so now look what you've done.
I have a great friend back home, and he's exactly the same. We call it comedy Tourette's. the gag comes to you in your head, and you can't hold it back.
It wouldn't be the Babes without at least one of those. So thank you for. See, you're an honor. You're already at functioning as a Baker Street Babe.
Yeah, we're nothing if not vastly inappropriate.
So you're talking about this play. Are you interested in directing at some point?
People have asked me that over the years, and it hasn't really been part of my thinking, really. Mm-hmm. I like being directed. I'm not sure that I want to hold all that amount of aces in my hand. I think I'm not quite dictatorial enough or egotistical enough, I think. Or clever enough. Like, I don't know quite what it is, but it hasn't struck me as one of my things yet. I think maybe when I'm older, I say that as if I'm young. but yeah, when I've got a bit more, even more experience, just to come back to that. I could direct a one-man show. I could handle myself. I know what actors are like, you see. That's the trouble. And so they couldn't pull the wool over my eyes when they come in, and that you know that they hung over.
In case anybody is unaware that's listening or here, how can they find you on social media?
So my Twitter is at Nellidge, NELLIDGE. I'm all over that. I'm on. I think I'm on as Nellidge on Instagram as well. Yeah, I'm a huge member of the Twitterati. I think that wasn't my guy. That was Stephen Fry's gag, I think. Again, Twitter's sort of one of these things that people either get or they don't get. And I sort of was a bit late to the party, and then sort of hooked into it in a big way. So I now use it. It's the best way of keeping up to date with news. You know, I remember watching it, and there was some siege that was going on, I think in Mombasa, and there were live tweets coming from the scene, and as a big news buff, I was like, wow, that it doesn't get more on the ground than that. You know, it's not all about people say, oh, you know, why are you tweeting, I just made a cup of tea, or why, you know. It's not really about that.
If you were going to boil down Stamford for you, what do you want people to take away when they watch Stamford? What specifically?
I think it's interesting in a program like that to have normality or perceived normality. I think that's what he represents in the program. He's ordinary, but and that's fine. You know, I think in life now I see it with kids, and they all don't. Nobody wants to be ordinary anymore. But I think it's a very good. It's a good thing to be, you know. He's got a level of intelligence, and he's confident within himself, but he doesn't have to stand out for any reason. There's no really. He doesn't feel the need to put his head above the parapet and shout, you know, "I am Mike Stamford."
So kind of the anti Sherlock.
The anti Sherlock, yeah. Moriarty again, you see. It's all there. The clues are all there. That's all I'm saying.
If it happens, you've heard it here. Well, we want to say a huge thank you for coming to the con and for speaking with us today and becoming an honorary babe. We are totally honored by that.
We're of course welcome to put into your, you know, your bio in your play.
Put it on your CV. Yep.
Yeah.
And in your playbills. We expect that.
Do you have any last comments that you'd like to make to our listeners or to our audience today?
No, I just, you know, from an actor's point of view, it's just interesting when something that you make or something that you're part of becomes part of this global phenomenon, and it's nothing, it sounds trite to say, but it is nothing without the people who care about it, the fans, and they get overlooked sometimes, and so I wanted to thank you guys for showing such an interest in the program and in me personally, making me feel so incredibly welcome. Everybody knows this was my first podcast, my first con. I'm doing a lot of firsts, and I think it's going to be hard to beat this one. So, thank you.